from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
I'm Rick Howlett. Today on In Conversation, we're going to talk about criminal justice and incarceration in Kentucky. The state's jail and prison populations dropped during 2020 in response to the pandemic, but the Vera Institute for Justice says those numbers are starting to trend in the other direction. Today, we'll discuss the impact of the pandemic and lessons learned from COVID in correctional facilities. We'll also check on the state of programs to aid crime victims and second chance opportunities for offenders. Plus, later in the program, we'll mark Asian and Pacific American Heritage Month. We want to hear from you this hour, too. Call us and join our discussion on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Good to have you with us today. We're going to spend most of today's show talking about something we haven't discussed much over the past year, incarceration and criminal justice in Kentucky and elsewhere. And then later in the program, we'll mark Asian and Pacific American Heritage Month and talk about how it's especially significant this year in light of recent events. But first, Kentucky's jails and prisons have, of course, been drastically impacted by COVID-19, due largely to the very nature of their construction and the way their populations are housed. The pandemic has also affected the criminal justice and court systems, the way proceedings are conducted. So as we emerge from the pandemic, we can kind of go back to talking about some of the issues we had tackled before COVID and through the lens of the pandemic, what we learned from COVID-19. In the correctional system. And joining us are Jasmine Heiss with the Vera Institute of Justice. Jasmine is the project director of In Our Backyards, an initiative at Vera exploring the shifting geography of mass incarceration and elevating the surprising truth that America's highest rates of incarceration are not in the biggest cities, but in the nation's hundreds of smaller cities, towns, and rural areas. The Vera Institute, among many other things, works with governments on various justice-related issues like incarceration. Jasmine, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Such a pleasure to be here, Chuck. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Ashley Spaulding, who is Research Director at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. And we journalists often refer to the center as left-leaning, but we often seek out the center's opinion and expertise on various issues, and that's what we're doing today with Ashley Spaulding. Ashley, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm really pleased to be here. Thanks.
Jeff Korzenek is chief investment strategist for Fifth Third Bank, where he is responsible for the investment strategy and the allocation of over $40 billion in assets. So you might be asking, what's he doing on a show about criminal justice and incarceration? Well, Jeff has written a book about hiring people with criminal records. It's called Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and Your Community. Jeff, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much, Rick.
We want to hear from you, too. Do you or someone you know have experiences with the criminal justice system in Kentucky or elsewhere? Is it related or not related to the COVID-19 pandemic? What changes do you think need to be made in the state's jails and prisons? What about finding a job after being convicted of a crime, as we're going to be talking with Jeff about that? What about victims of crimes? Are they getting the support they need? We want to hear what you think. Call us 502-814-TALK, 502-814-8255. We're on Twitter. WFPL News is our handle, and you can also reach out through Facebook. We did reach out, I should note, to the Kentucky Justice and Public Safety Cabinet to invite someone to participate in the show, but they said no one would be available today. So hopefully we can talk to someone from the cabinet at another time. So, Jasmine, let's start with you, and let's, of course, start with COVID and incarcerations. Here in Kentucky, there have been, of course, thousands of positive cases among both the populations and staff in Kentucky facilities, dozens of deaths. A number of actions were taken by officials, including some early releases and restrictions on visitors. What is the Vera Institute's assessment of how Kentucky has handled COVID-19 in its local jails and prisons?
Thank you so much for that question, Rick. I think, you know, it is such an important moment to reflect on what happened over the past year in our nation's prisons and jails, and specifically, as you say, in the Commonwealth prisons and jails. I will say, you know, sort of top line, the most important thing is that we saw this unprecedented decline in incarceration across the country and certainly in Kentucky in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. And, you know, unsurprisingly, that was really spurred by a recognition that in prisons and jails, it is impossible to social distance. It is often impossible for people to take the steps that were necessary to stay safe, including, you know, wearing masks, regularly washing their hands, for people whose movements are controlled and curtailed by incarceration itself. We knew very early that, as in other congregate settings, it was going to be very dangerous. And so I really want to commend the leadership, among others, of Chief Justice Minton, who very early urged judges across the state, urged local justice systems to take action to urgently decrease jail populations. What we saw is a more than 20% decline in both jail and prison incarceration in the state in response to the pandemic. And, you know, I think that what that underscores for Kentucky and for many states across the country is that rapid decarceration or the rapid reduction in the number of people behind bars was always possible. And at the level of jails, right, one of the things that stands out is this is not necessarily because there were mass releases of people, although certainly there were releases from state prison. Instead, it was simply because of the choice no longer to book many people into jail. And so we saw, you know, overall, the biggest declines in bookings for offenses like driving offenses, drug offenses, traffic offenses. Things I think that many of us would say, you know, do we really need to be using the nation's jails and Kentucky's jails to respond to some of these social problems? In the framing, you know, often of bipartisan consensus around this issue, we hear, are we using incarceration to respond to people who we're afraid of? So people who, you know, pose a community safety risk, for example, or people that we're mad at. And I think overwhelmingly, what decarceration during COVID illuminated is that it was possible and remains possible simply not to use jail for things that are social problems. As you foreshadowed, right, we also see this really concerning trend in the opposite direction, jail populations climbing again. And I'm happy to dive into that. But again, I want to underscore that the overall story was one of incredible decline. Now, just pausing for a moment, we also saw, as you said, that people continued to get sick and die behind bars, both staff and incarcerated people. And I think that also underscores that even more could have been done.
Just as a side note, we just heard from Governor Andy Beshear talking about the new CDC guidance on masks, and masks will be mandated in correction facilities for the foreseeable future. That's the mask mandate has not been lifted for correctional facilities. It's just as a side note. Let me ask you about jail populations, because it looks like I think the Vera Institute noted that after that drop during the height of the pandemic, as we emerge now, it looks like things are starting to trend in the other direction. Is that right?
Unfortunately, that is right. And I think, you know, first, it's worth saying that Kentucky sort of entered the COVID-19 pandemic, began the pandemic with the second highest rate of jail admissions in the country and systemic overcrowding across the jail system. And so it really was due to the reductions in response to COVID-19 that the overall number of people in jail across the Commonwealth dropped below the number of beds for the first time in a very long time. Now, you know, that said, there is this rebound happening. So if we look at the trajectory of just the county jail population or the local jail population, so those would be people who are held pretrial, the majority on unaffordable money bail, or people sentenced to, you know, shorter sentences, misdemeanor sentences in jails, that population increased nearly 70% from a low in about mid-May 2020 to late April. And as again, you sort of foreshadowed in talking about our work at the Vera Institute and my work, what we see beneath that top line number is that the rural jail incarceration rate is more than twice as high as in the state's biggest city, as in Jefferson County. And so in many ways, right, this catastrophic return to normal, this very precipitous rise is being fueled by the state's smallest counties.
Does the Vera Institute track federal prison numbers as well?
We do. So we've looked both at BOP, so the number of people in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, but also the other federal number. So both people in U.S. Marshals custody, which is, you know, majority federal pretrial custody, and in the custody of ICE. And what we saw, right, is for the most part, a similar trajectory in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, that there was some decline. But I think when we talk about those two agencies, the other facets of the federal system, a really striking difference emerges. ICE numbers declined overall really dramatically in 2020. And that was in part, you know, due to some of the policies implemented by the previous administration to reduce the flow of people into the country at the border. But on the other hand, what we saw is that the U.S. Marshals population didn't decline at all. The number of people in federal pretrial detention actually in 2020 reached an all-time high, according to testimony of the director before Congress. And, you know, that also has implications, as you may well know, for jail populations across the Commonwealth, because people who were being housed for the federal government are actually in local jails across the country, including in Kentucky. And what we saw really alarmingly is, you know, despite this public health emergency, people in federal pretrial detention continue to be transferred across state lines, continue to be transferred to communities with a very fragile sort of public safety or health safety net, you know, not a very robust public health system. And I think this really underscores how we often talk about incarceration as a public health issue for people who are in facilities, but it can impact entire communities, particularly because people tend to churn in and out of local jails. The virus certainly did not just stay behind bars.
Let me turn to you, Ashley Spaulding, with the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. And first of all, before we go to a break, for those who may not know, tell us about what you do, what the center does, what you do at the center, especially in terms of criminal justice and incarceration.
Sure. So we are a nonprofit, nonpartisan research and advocacy organization, and we work on a range of policies that will improve the lives of Kentuckians across the state. And those include specifically economic policies related to the state budget and revenue and high quality jobs. And we do. We've been doing for a number of years now work specifically focused on criminal justice issues. And a lot of that work has been, in recent years, has been on the topic of pretrial issues or the need for bail reform in our state. And so we've done a lot of work on that. And we've been really fortunate to hire a great policy analyst, Carmen Mitchell, who's focusing on these issues and has been expanding our work to include policing issues. And we've had the chance to work with the Vera Institute, looking in our own backyards at what is happening at the local level and across the state in terms of the role of jails in driving mass incarceration in our state. So we've worked on a lot of things, and I'm really happy to be here to talk about these issues today.
We're going to get back into it more deeply. We need to take a break. That's Ashley Spaulding with the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. We'll talk more with her and with Jeff Korzenik, who has written the book Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community, and Jasmine Heiss from the Vera Institute. It's all coming up after a break on In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett. We are talking about criminal justice and incarceration here in Kentucky and elsewhere, and our guests are Ashley Spaulding, Research Director at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy, Jasmine Heist is director of the In Our Backyards Initiative at the Vera Institute of Justice. And Jeff Korzenik is with us. He is an investment strategist, chief investment strategist for Fifth Third Bank, and author of Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. And we're going to spend the rest of this segment talking about incarceration in Kentucky and elsewhere. And we welcome your input. 502-814-TALK is our number. 502-814-8255. You can send us a tweet. WFPL News is our handle, and we're also on Facebook. And we were talking with Ashley about the work of the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. And Ashley, you mentioned pretrial operations and pretrial services and bails and that sort of thing. I hate to keep harping on the pandemic, but it has affected everybody in such a profound way. How has it affected folks who are awaiting trial or are going through the justice system? How has that affected those who, especially those who, from the time of their arrest to the time of their incarceration, and then waiting for the next step to happen?
Sure. Well, to talk about what's changed, I want to talk just briefly about what it looked like before. And Jasmine highlighted some of the issues where we just see prior to COVID and after as well. But prior to COVID, a lot of Kentuckians were awaiting trial. In terms of that point in the system, these are people presumed innocent by law, awaiting trial in jail, incarcerated, even though just because they don't have the money to get out because they're subject to money bail. And there are so many harms to pretrial incarceration that we knew about, that the research pointed to prior to COVID. And then with COVID, the greater likelihood that a person would get COVID and be harmed by it, were added to that as well. So prior to the pandemic, we did an analysis, a couple years ago, a report called Disparate Justice, where we looked at the share of cases in our state where money bail, where the cases were subject to money bail in order to be released. And it's about, at that point, it was like 40% of cases, just 40% of cases were not subject to money bail. So the majority of cases would require an individual to come up with a certain amount in order to be released pretrial and to await trial outside of jail. And people who are incarcerated pretrial are more likely to be found guilty, even when innocent, they're more likely to plead guilty. And just down the road, there are so many harms, losing a job and the impact on families, and people can stay incarcerated pretrial for a really long time. And so we were describing the situation in Kentucky, where you also see some counties, there almost all cases are subject to money bail, and in other cases, there are more releases. So with COVID-19, these harms of pretrial incarceration became even more understandable, and the harms were even greater with the risk of contracting COVID-19 while being held pretrial. And so as Jasmine was saying, our state did act, and the Supreme Court put out an order that expanded what's called administrative release in our state, and that is where prior to last spring, administrative release in our state was applied to most misdemeanors, but not low-level felonies, and so an individual who was arrested for a misdemeanor, if it was nonviolent, non-sexual in nature, in most cases would be released without having to go before a judge, just automatically released, and then they would need to come back to court for their court dates. But they were not subject to money bail. So the Supreme Court orders, there were yes.
You can go ahead. Finish
I'll
your thought.
Just quickly. I'm sorry. Yeah, a series of them in response to COVID-19 expanded the cases where people were eligible for administrative release to Class D felonies, the low-level felonies. And that means that what we saw, and we were able to look at the data through the end of last year, and the number of cases resulting in release through administrative release, so not being subject to money bail, doubled compared to previous years. And then we were able to see the data on some data on that, the outcomes. Well, what happened? Well, in 89% of these cases, there was no rearrest. And so we really want our state, see the opportunity for our state to make these changes permanent. There's not an official expiration, but these changes aren't necessarily permanent. You know, we want these changes to be permanent, and we want the state to build on the lessons that we can learn that, you know, incarceration isn't, high rates of incarceration are not healthy, that we should be releasing more people, that people should not be stuck in jail with all of the harms that come with that while they're awaiting trial. And we have the data now to show to kind of head off a lot of the concerns that people have.
Let's talk about those who have been through the system, who have been convicted of a crime and are now looking to reemerge, to get back, to get a job, and to, in many cases, turn their lives around. That's where we bring in Jeff Korzenick, who has written the book Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. He's a chief investment strategist for Fifth Third Bank. Jeff, tell us about the book and what prompted you to write it.
Sure. About 6-7 years ago, we became at the bank very focused on problems in the labor force, because this was something that was plaguing our customers. Couldn't find people to hire to grow their businesses, and it was a real impediment for U.S. growth. And we started doing a deeper dive into the issue and came to the conclusion that, unlike previous cycles in modern American economic history, social ills were playing a big, big role in holding back our labor force growth. And it was long-term unemployment, the opioid epidemic, and the incarceration recidivism cycle. And at the same time, we started studying companies, the pioneering companies that had figured out ways to bring people back and turn people who had had troubled lives, had made mistakes, but had paid their dues, and turn them into very productive employees and through supportive employment. And it was a business model, and we started spreading the word. We did speaking panels in Louisville, for instance, but really needed to magnify this message, leverage this message. So the book became the practical guide to the business case and best practices of how you do it, using real-life examples of these pioneering employers.
Well, I know we've been talking a lot lately. I think we're going to do a show on it down the road about worker shortages, especially here in the midst of the pandemic and in light of the unemployment assistance and all that sort of thing. So do you find that this philosophy is particularly important now with a lot of folks looking to hire people?
Absolutely. And in fact, we believe that what's going on right now, the widespread labor shortages we're all hearing about, is really a foreshadowing of what we can expect for the next decade and more. The pandemic has, which we in our work called the Great Disruption, has disrupted all sorts of patterns and of employment and where people live. And that's created a lot of mismatches in the job market. It's put a lot of people sidelined from the job market for good who aren't coming back and looking for work. So it's creating a shortage. But the long-term trend is demographic in nature. Birth rates in the United States peaked in 1990 cyclically. That was the millennial baby boom, have been declining since. Our fertility rate, which gives us a long-term view, means we are not even replacing our population. So the ability to grow an economy is predicated upon the ability to grow your workforce at the business level. You need people to service your customers, to produce your products, to grow your business. And this has increased the focus of the business community on alternatives. The answer becomes digging deeper into our population to find people who have been marginalized from the labor force and find ways to bring them back in. I'll add there was a very significant development at the end of last month that I don't think got the attention it deserved, the creation of a new Second Chance Business Coalition. It's co-chaired by J.P. Morgan's Jamie Dimon and the CEO of Eaton Corp, Craig Arnold. It's about 20 or 30 of real brand name U.S. companies that have all made a commitment, not in kind of a vague way, but a very specific commitment to creating trial programs, sharing best practices. And many of the companies that are part of this coalition, say Kroger Stores, which employs nearly 500,000 people in the United States, already have second chance programs. So this is a real sea change in the business community. I think it's an important step in the right direction.
Well, I know a big obstacle for a lot of people, and we've actually done some programs, done a program on it, is expungement, as that can be expensive, it can be time-consuming, and having that record, that criminal record can prevent you from getting the job that you're looking for in many cases. What's your assessment of Kentucky's expungement laws and those throughout the rest of the country, and is there room for improvement?
Expungement is important. The challenge with expungement is most expungement laws require someone to have been already outside of incarceration for a period, often of years, before you can be granted an expungement. And yet it's those first couple of years that are the real challenge for people leaving incarceration. But I think the Commonwealth has taken very important steps. There's a new bill that was passed that goes into law in July of this year. That's House Bill 497, which, among other things, requires the Kentucky Department of Corrections to help prepare people for employment better, but critically gives them the right to earn a certificate of employability. That certificate of employability gives a safe haven for employers who do not have to worry about negligent hiring liability, which is a big obstacle in the mind of many employers to hiring people with records. So I think Kentucky has made some huge strides through this kind of reform that will be very productive. But it's still a matter of educating the business community. One of the things that became apparent in our research is that there are wrong ways and right ways to do this. You need a process for determining who's ready to turn their life around and build a career. And then you have to understand that this population, often because of lives of trauma or deep poverty, not because of a criminal record, have gaps and skills gaps, soft skills gaps, things like that, that lack of mentoring that employers need to be aware of and provide accommodation for. They don't have to go it alone. They can work with nonprofits in many cases very successfully. But when you do it right, when you find the person who's ready to turn their life around, when you equip them to succeed, you get not just an adequate employee, not an employee of last resort, but you actually get an exceptionally engaged and loyal employee. That's a recipe for productivity and profitability for employers.
You're listening to In Conversation on WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. We're talking about incarceration and criminal justice in Kentucky and elsewhere. You just heard Jeff Korzenek, who has written a book about hiring people who have criminal records, people who have been convicted of crimes. The book is called Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. Also with us is Ashley Spaulding, Research Director at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy, and Jasmine Heiss from the Vera Institute of Justice. And we welcome your input. 502-814-TALK is our number. 502-814-8255. Send us a tweet if you'd rather do it that way. Our handle is WFPL News. You can reach us on Facebook as well. Jasmine, I want to come back to you because we haven't, I know the Vera Institute covers a lot of territory, not just incarceration. That's the Vera Institute for Justice. And I know you have a component for victims. In a lot of these cases, there are devastating results for victims. Talk about what types of programs are available that the Vera Institute of Justice endorses. And bringing back COVID, how have victim services been affected by the pandemic?
So that's a great question. And I think underscoring that, all people who are impacted by the justice system and the criminal legal system and the systems that are meant to deliver safety and justice, it necessarily includes a conversation about victims. We have incredible colleagues who lead the work in our center on victimization and safety. And, one of the things I'll say that I think often gets lost in the conversation about victims and survivors of crime is that in all axes, right, people who are differently abled, people who are marginalized in other ways, who have also been victimized, are often left out of the conversation. And that is a lot of the work that my colleagues specifically do, whether it is, ensuring that people with disabilities are able to access healing and safety, whether it is people, for example, who are deaf or children with disabilities. And also thinking expansively about, you know, for example, keeping survivors of domestic violence and their children safe. I am certainly not the best equipped to speak to the full range of Vera's work on victims and victim services, particularly because I focus almost monomaniacally on jails as really the front door of the system. But one of the things that I will say is, you know, as with all behavioral health resources and services, it became very difficult for people to access many of the things that they were used to during COVID, certainly. And I think one of the sort of lessons to take away from that, right, is not just how do you sort of create rapid responses we saw in the courts with things moving online, with, for example, treatment resources and services, with supportive services for survivors and victims of crime moving online, but how do we come out of this and build a more robust infrastructure to ensure the health and safety of all people? And one of the things that has really been top of mind, I think, for us at Vera and for me is the influx of local money that is going to be going or coming to counties and to cities through the American Rescue Plan Act, which has really been framed expansively, not only as an opportunity to help communities recover from COVID, but also to address historical and systemic inequities and to create more, you know, robust, resilient communities. And so I think there is a real opportunity as these billions of dollars flow from Treasury directly to communities to say, what are the priorities across the country that really emanate both from people who have been most harmed by the criminal justice system and people who have been harmed by crime to prioritize community healing and community safety? And, you know, I know that your listenership is broad, but I would say this is, again, a real moment to have a conversation about what community safety looks like and what kinds of investments can further a true vision of safety.
Just about out of time. Jeff, is your book been published yet?
It was published last month, yes, by HarperCollins Leadership.
And it is called Untapped Talent, How Second Chance Hiring Works for Your Business and the Community. Jeff Korzenich is a chief investment strategist for Fifth Third Bank and author of that book, and it's available wherever you get books. Ashley Spaulding, thank you for your input as well. Glad to have you with us, research director at the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy. And again, thanks to Jasmine Heiss, director of the In Our Backyards initiative at the Vera Institute of Justice. Of course, they have a presence on the internet as well. Thank you all for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Rex. Such a pleasure.
Thank you.
When we come
back,
thank you very much. We're going to mark Asian and Pacific American Heritage Month after a break. You're listening to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Welcome back to In Conversation on 89.3 WFPL and Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville. Well, May is Asian and Pacific American Heritage Month. It started out as a week celebrating Asians and Pacific Islanders in the U.S., and it was expanded by Congress to include the whole month of May in 1992. According to the Library of Congress and AsianPacificHeritage.gov, this month was chosen to commemorate, May was, the immigration of the first Japanese to the United States on May 7, 1843, and to mark the anniversary of the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad on May 10, 1869. The majority of the workers who laid the tracks were, of course, Chinese immigrants. And joining us now to talk about Asian and Pacific Heritage Month and their lives in the U.S. and Kentucky are Dr. Keiko Tanaka, professor of rural sociology in the Department of Community and Leadership Department in the University of Kentucky College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment. Keiko, welcome to the program. You want to be called Keiko instead of Dr. Tanaka, right? Welcome.
Yes. Thank you. Nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. Daniel Wu is with us, Lexington business owner, restaurateur, and community activist. Daniel, welcome to you.
Hi, how's it going? And it's just Dan.
All right, Dan, thank you. Keiko, you're Japanese-American. Dan, you came to the U.S. With your family from China, I believe when you were 8 years old. Let me start with you, Keiko. This month of May, Asian and Pacific Islander Awareness, or Heritage Month, rather, it doesn't seem to get the same coverage as other heritage months typically do. I'm glad our producer, Michelle, brought it up for the show this week. It really hasn't been high on a lot of people's radar. Why do you think that is?
That is one of the big issues we are concerned about. It's a reflection of invisibility of Asian Americans in general in this society. As far as I am aware of, I don't know any particular event specifically scheduled, for example, in Lexington. May tend to be very, very busy month for everybody. Universities are going through commencement. Schools are ending their academic year. So I think it just fly off to people's mind.
I guess May was chosen, as I mentioned earlier, by these various historical dates. Do you do anything at the university or in Lexington to mark this month?
So we had the beginning of the month, we did have a walk to basically it's kind of like a walk to the library, to the student center, to celebrate opening of the Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month. That was the event organized by UK's International Center and the China Initiative. Unfortunately, I was not able to attend, but in month of April, often students do organize some activities around Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month instead of May because they will be done with the semester.
What about you, Dan? Do you do anything special to commemorate this month?
Honestly, for me, I just kind of take to social media and my friend groups and kind of highlight Asian American culture, as I know it, in the United States. Because, you know, what you said about Asian American History and Heritage Month not getting a whole lot of press, and Keiko mentioned the idea of the invisibility. I mean, our culture is very, very visible. Our food, entertainment, anime, martial arts, all these sort of elements that are deeply part of American culture are very visible, and yet the people behind these cultures are often very much seen as invisible. So, my ethos when I talk about Asian American culture is always like, I wish Americans could love us as people the way you love and accept our culture.
That's very interesting. Tell us about your experience. As I mentioned, you came here as a child from China, right, Dan?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right. I came here as a kid when I was about 8 years old. We moved to Fargo, North Dakota, and then we came to Lexington when I was about 12. And I've lived on both coasts since. I've lived in Brooklyn, I've lived in San Francisco, and now I've been back in Lexington for a while now. I very much consider myself a Lexingtonian and a Kentuckian.
And you operate, you have more than one restaurant or one restaurant currently?
Right now, so I opened up Atomic Ramen, in 2017, but unfortunately COVID shut us down last year. So I have a partnership with the University of Kentucky, and I'm operating out of one of the dining halls here on campus.
And Keiko, what's your experience in Kentucky? Did you move here from another part of the U.S.?
Yes. I emigrated from Japan to U.S. in 1985
to study sociology. So I spent 10 years or so in the state of Michigan. And after I finished my PhD degree from Michigan State, I went to New Zealand to work for 3 years as a professor. And then I moved to Kentucky because I was offered a position at the University of Kentucky.
Well, I know you both have been very active in responding to these outbreaks of hate crimes against Asian people in other parts of the country. What's going on here, Dan? I guess we've heard it mentioned that, you know, that maybe this is rooted in some sort of illogical response to the outbreak of the virus, first of all, in China. But why do you think that's been on the increase lately?
I mean, a lot of people pin the uptick in anti-Asian hate on our previous president and his very generally xenophobic and anti-immigrant rhetoric, and then calling, you know, coronavirus the Kung flu and the China virus and the Wuhan flu certainly did not help. But he's not the source of, you know, these sort of ideas and prejudices and hate. I mean, these elements have been within our society since day one. I mean, we live in a racist country. And so what's happened, I think, in the past year or so is that the previous president has made it okay to say things out loud that otherwise people would whisper among themselves. He's kind of given license for folks to kind of be out there with it. And, you know, ultimately physical violence is an extension of rhetorical violence. And that's what we've seen.
Keiko, are you in agreement with that? I know you've been active at UK in responding. Go ahead.
Yes, I'm totally in agreement with Dan. And Dan and I, we've been friends for years, and then we work together on the various initiatives. Part of the problem is that I think the American in general have a hard time placing Asian Americans in this kind of racialized in a scheme of white, black, Hispanic type of race categories. Where shall we put in the Asian American as a category? In some cases, they would praise about how successful Asian Americans are. Look at the Asian American successes, that other racial minority could do the same thing. On the other hand, when we look at the situations like the current violence against Asian Americans, and as well as this Kung Fu virus, all those rhetoric, Asian Americans are constantly treated as forever foreigners, that they are not part of so-called ethos of American. And then I think that is the historical, long historical root. I'm not a historian. However, that there's a long root rooted in the history of immigrants from Asia.
We are talking about Asian and Pacific Heritage Month. In Conversation, May is Asian and Pacific Heritage Month. On In Conversation, 89.3 WFPL in Kentucky Public Radio. I'm Rick Hallett, and we're talking with Dr. Keiko Tanaka, who is professor of rural sociology in the Department of Community and Leadership Development at the UK College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment, and Daniel Wu, restaurateur and community activist, also in Lexington. Well, let's celebrate this month. Let's talk about what you want to celebrate. Let me start with you, Dan. What do you want people to know about Asians and Chinese in particular that in Kentucky that they may not know? What should we be celebrating?
I think, you know, ultimately, I want to celebrate not just the culture and contributions from Asian Americans to not just Kentucky, but to the country in terms of our labor. I mean, this country would not function, its economy would not function without immigrants. Our contributions in terms of the culture, and I think particularly food, is where most people sort of have their sort of entry and relationship with Asian and Asian American culture. But I would say, you know, to take that a step beyond, what I would like for people to do is to celebrate the people, you know what I mean? Get to know the people behind these cultures and these contributions, and you know, raise us up and support us.
Well, what about you, Keiko? What comes to mind when you think of celebrating Asian Americans and Asian various Asian cultures?
Yes. And then when we look at, for example, Kentucky's economy, how much of it depends on trade with the Asian countries. Also, when we look at the healthcare industry, universities, Asian descent, Asian Americans are contributed to enriching our science, education, higher education. So there's a lot to be celebrated. I think what I would like to see is people to see Asian American as they are. I mean, today there was a report in the NBC News that 42% of Americans could not name a single Asian American. And this was a survey conducted by a nonprofit leading Asian American to Unite for Change. And that is surprising considering we have a vice president who is Asian American descent.
Right. What I know we talked about the uptick in Asian hate in other parts of the country. Has there been any incidents here in our area, Dan, that you're aware of? And what's been your experience? Are people supportive of you in Lexington and around your area where you live?
Yeah, thankfully there haven't been really significant incidents, and thankfully nothing that is terrible enough to make the national news. And I think, you know, partly the uptick in these incidents, it's not just the very publicized violence and killings and the Atlanta murders. So much of it takes the form of sort of microaggressions and beyond of insults of, you know, go back to where you came from, of, you know, people making ching chong noises at you or pulling, you know, the corners of their eyes, or even certain things that seem positive on its face, like complimenting you on your English or asking you where you're from. All those sort of things contribute to sort of just the generalized noise of our lives that continue to, if not, you know, physically and verbally assault us, but just continue to, as Keiko said, paint us as the perpetual foreigner, continually other us, no matter how long we've been in this country, no matter if we've been in this country for generations, as long as you have this face, you're still treated as a foreigner. And that has a lot of, honestly, generational trauma, not in the same way that, say, Black Americans face in this country, but certainly another facet of how sort of racism manifests.
And Keiko, has that been your experience as well? It's more, I mean, obviously these terrible, terrible things that have been happening exist, but the microaggressions and the things that Dan referred to?
Yeah, and I have heard from faculty members with the small children that though their children are being bullied at the park, at school, and then asked to go home, go back to where you come from. So it's not just adults. It's you know, throughout the ages. And also, I think what is disappointing is that many of the Asian American people are living in the fear, even to this day. And then I think that Atlanta incident heightened that fear and anxiety of what if, you know, it could be me, the type of a situation that, you know, they're so afraid to go outside and then be with, you know, go back to the normal activities.
Tell us about what you teach. You're a professor of rural sociology. I didn't know that actually exists. I've heard of sociology, but not rural sociology. Tell us about that. What's your experience with that?
Yes, I teach courses usually on sustainable agriculture, farming, and how the food system change over time as a sociologist. And then, so I also teach a course called Food in the Society in Asia. And I talk about how the curry, it's called curry and the ramen class. And then talking about the transformations of those two items, why they became what they are today as we know it. And then tracing the histories of curry and ramen, we talk about immigration, colonialism, World War One and Two, and how those had an impact upon the food culture and this idea of authentic curry or authentic ramen and so forth.
I haven't looked at the demographics in the Lexington area. Is there a significant sized Asian community in Lexington and in that region?
Yeah. So at the state level, Asian American and Native Hawaiian, the Pacific Islanders only constitute about 1.54%. But Fayette County has 4.4%. Jefferson County has 3.2%, so far bigger than the state average. And then I don't quite understand why, but Warren County has 5% Asian American Pacific Islander population. So the major university towns tend to have a little three large Asian American Pacific Island population.
That's interesting. Before we go, Dan, tell us about your restaurant, where it's located, and again, Atomic Ramen, right?
Yes, Atomic Ramen. At the moment, we're serving out of the 90 Dining Hall here on the campus of University of Kentucky. And today, incidentally, is actually our last day of operation, as it's also the last day of school here at UK. So hopefully, we'll see students back in the fall.
And I'm sure you've been impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic as well. What are your plans for the future?
Plans are up in the air right now. Like I said, we had to close our brick-and-mortar restaurant last summer. And now it's kind of a wait and see to see how the restaurant industry bounces back. We've finally gotten the restaurant relief bill in this past big stimulus bill. So hopefully a lot of restaurants will be coming back. But as you probably know, there's also a really bad labor shortage in the service sector right now. So many things are kind of in flux, and you know, it's a stressful industry to begin with. And right now there's so many uncertainties. So the answer to your question is, I don't know yet.
Okay, well, we wish you all the best. Been a joy having both of you, Dan Wu and Dr. Keiko Tanaka. And happy Asian and Pacific American Heritage Month to you and to everyone. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's all the time we have for In Conversation. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for listening.